miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turn into boys on the lone highway. Rest up creeps die on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Honey, on the lone highway. Left me for another on the lone highway. They killed Dirty Dog McGee on the lone highway. Stroked a little girl's hair on the lone highway. On the lone highway.
Hello and welcome to Operation Scorpio. Today's date is May 8, 2021. And welcome to the free-range open-air insane asylum we call Earth. Well, guys, here we are. Here we are living in the post-truth world and living in the post-human era. Yes, depopulation is now the name of the game. Controlling the number of cattle, I mean people, alive through a long-term program of vaccination. Yes, and you know the title of Mullen's book, Eustace Mullen's book, Murder by Injection, that was certainly a prophetic title, wasn't it? Written back in the 1980s, nonetheless. Amazing. And make no mistake, we are living in an era where the parasitical elite class of chicken swingers are hell-bent on killing as many people as possible. Oh, yeah. By hook or by crook, they intend to get the job done. There's no turning back now, guys. We have crossed the Rubicon. And I'll tell you, you know, this push to vaccinate the entire planet, this really is the greatest act of propaganda and mind control ever attempted in recorded human history. And really, we have to ask ourselves, why is that? Why is vaccination so important? Because they care? Because they want us to be healthy? Unlikely, at best. And, I saw this advertisement for this Vax Live concert. Maybe you guys have seen this. This big concert, it was recorded, I guess, May 2nd in Los Angeles. Just absolutely disgusting. And, you know, all these big celebrities are there, right? You know, performing like monkeys. And the big, you know, headline is, time to reunite the world. Yes, reunite the world. And on the background of the stage is a big sign that says, global citizen. Huh, you'd almost think they're trying to get a message across here to us, if I didn't know better. And I guess it's going to be aired tonight. Ooh, that's an event you don't want to miss. And don't forget, every celebrity involved in that concert or event is a traitor. Make no mistake. They are all traitors, every single one of them. And really, they've sold their souls for a handful of shekels. That's what it comes down to, guys. Traitors. These people are to be reviled, not worshipped or put on some kind of pedestal. You know, they're just trained monkeys, nothing more. And of course, if somehow this virus scenario doesn't play out, I think, you know, plan B is some kind of staged World War III. The stage is already being set, isn't it? They're moving the chess pieces on the board. And isn't it funny, you know, how they describe Russia's being very aggressive. They're putting troops on the Ukrainian border. No, Russia's moving troops around within its own country. NATO is actually doing, you know, military exercises literally kilometers away from the Russian border. But Russia's the aggressor. They're the bad guys. Oh, yeah. But of course, now we are supposed to be afraid of one another, and really just, you know, viewing each other as a bag of virus infested flesh, just waiting to spread the contagion by the very act of breathing. Oh, yeah. Breathing without a mask on is now an act of selfishness. You might be killing people after all. And, you know, I actually had someone tell me I was killing people for not wearing a mask. I mean, this guy was practically frothing at the mouth, you know, crazed. And I just had to laugh at him and say, oh, yeah, really? Is that so? Are you a doctor or a virologist or someone that just watches television and believes everything he sees? Unbelievable. And of course, now a new element of fear has been thrown into the mix, hasn't it? This notion of self-replicating vaccines, we are being told. Vaccines that essentially, you know, turn the vaccinated into, you know, virus production factories, just churning out viruses and spike protein particles with every breath. And, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. I don't know. Only time will tell on that one. But we should at least consider the possibility that, you know, this is essentially a potential misinformation campaign designed to induce fear amongst the unvaccinated and the so-called truther movement. And, you know, and I'm not saying that the doctors who are theorizing this scenario are deliberately misleading us. I'm just stating the possibility that they might have been misinformed themselves or have drawn the wrong conclusions. Or maybe an insider was feeding some of them information or misinformation. Who knows? You know, I don't know. Only time will tell. We'll have to wait and see on that one. But frankly, I'm pretty skeptical of it. And, you know, from the point of view of the conspirators, you know, if you're writing this script that we're all living in right now, and the end game, of course, is to create a new system, you know, where the vaccine is required to work or go to school. You know, the script would have to read out that the vaccine was a great success and saved countless millions of lives, regardless of how many people actually are maimed, made sick, and died from it. The enemy war transmissions known as the mainstream media will keep that narrative going, or at least that's the plan. And, you know, I just heard this morning that Pfizer is already seeking full approval for their vaccine, or their quaxine, as Giuseppe calls it, for people 16 and older, full approval. And, you know, chances are it's already a done deal, or they wouldn't have put it on the news, would they have? If there's any chance of it being turned down due to health dangers, they wouldn't be talking about this already. And of course, the commentator on the news already, you know, let the cat out of the bag, essentially, that this opens the door for employers to require the vaccine to be able to work, and for schools to be requiring the vaccine. And of course, schools, you know, we've already been pushed into this through schools for a long, long time. I mean, God, what's the, in California, when I left California, I think the vaccination requirement was something like 53 or 56 vaccines by the time you reached high school. Amazing. And, you know, once they can require the vaccine, then they can control the population, can't they? The human herd can be controlled in terms of numbers very easily over time. Yes, that's why they keep talking about herd immunity, something that'll never happen. But referring to people as animals, they do it all the time. Just like in the schools under the new reopening requirements, they're talking about children being in pods, like a pod of dolphins or, you know, killer whales or whatever, right? Animals only able to interact with other children within their pod. And I've heard this same term used for summer camps. You know, the children will be in their pod. This is bizarre, isn't it? It's hard to believe this is the world we live in now. And of course, as people, you know, die off from the planned vaccination programs, they can simply be replaced by more and more immigrants. And remember, guys, they're playing the long game here. This doesn't all have to be accomplished, you know, all at once. As long as they get the majority of it implemented, that's what is important. The rest can come later. But that's why it's so important for everyone to refuse to participate in this. This really is the hill to die for, guys, right now, right here. And, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, going back to this subject of, you know, people shedding viruses or spike proteins when they breathe. You know, I ran into this couple who are quite aware of the vaccine agenda and sort of the fraudulent nature of, you know, this whole COVID agenda. But, you know, and this was a couple that refused to wear a mask. They wouldn't do it. But I saw them the other day and they were both wearing masks because they were afraid of people, you know, shedding viruses and spike protein particles. You know, they were afraid that the vaccinated were going to make them sick. So, you know, it's a sad thing to see. And they found another way to keep a whole new group of people in fear. And that's really the point, isn't it? And who knows, maybe, you know, maybe they're right. Maybe this spike protein particles are going to go everywhere. I don't know. But one thing I do know is I am not going to wear a mask. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to walk around like a slave in fear, no matter what happens. No matter what happens. And really, you know, if it's God's will that I breathe in a nanoparticle of spike protein or something like that and die, then so be it. And I'm not trying to be flippant here or, you know, make light of it. I'm very serious. I've really thought about such a possibility. It is possible. But if that's the case, I will die as a free man, not as a slave. Slaves live in fear. They live in constant fear. Fear of being punished by their masters. Don't forget that, guys. And fear is the most powerful tool of the satanic forces. Fear is their most powerful tool. There's no question about that, guys. Everything they do is based on fear. Fear as a means to control. Yeah, that's heavy stuff. You know, and a free man has made his peace with God and rejects fear. We must all reject fear in our lives, and it's not an easy thing to do. It's a struggle every day, but it's something to always remember. And also, man, you know, we got to always remember to ask for God's protection. It's a very real thing, not to be taken lightly. And, you know, we have to ask through prayer or meditation. Something's easy to forget as we live our physical lives every day. Yeah. Well, you know, it was good to hear Fetch back on the air. I'm glad that he's on the mend. Quite a story. Quite a story. But at least he's on the mend and back on the air. That's a good thing. And I want to thank everyone out there in the chat room. Got a full house there at Revolution Radio. And over at Rising Tide Media, plenty of people chatting away with insightful comments. That's very important. So anyway, I'm going to kind of switch gears here a little bit. And, you know, I watched a very interesting documentary the other day called Dark Clouds Over Elberton. Dark Clouds Over Elberton. And I'll put the link up later in the chat. And, you know, it's about the Georgia Guidestones. It's really the whole story of the Georgia Guidestones. And it was made back in 2015. And I highly recommend, you know, taking the time to watch it. Because, you know, they actually go into Elberton, Georgia. That's where the Guidestones are, outside of Elberton. And it's known as the granite capital of Georgia, Elberton. And it really goes into, you know, interview the people who were involved in this, you know, in this small town, going through and interviewing firsthand accounts of what happened. And of course, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about the Georgia Guidestones. And of course, the most famous part of it is the, you know, keeping humanity under 500 million. And that's a very relevant topic now, isn't it, given what we're living through? And, you know, frankly, I always kind of suspected that Ted Turner might have been involved in the project, you know, just speculating, only because, you know, the dates matched up, you know, 1980, that was, you know, kind of Ted Turner's heyday in a way. And the state, Georgia, that's where Ted Turner's from. But it looks like really, you know, Ted Turner had nothing to do with the Georgia Guidestones whatsoever. Although he does share the ideology behind them. This ideology of controlling the human population by force. And, you know, many members of the elite and billionaire class share those same beliefs. And, you know, it's really interesting. The documentary kind of starts off showing the unveiling ceremony of the Georgia Guidestones back in March 22nd, 1980. You know, spring 1980. And I've never seen that footage anywhere. I don't know how they found it. I guess this documentary was made in 2015. But I've never seen that footage of the unveiling ceremony of the Georgia Guidestones. Very interesting. And the most important part of this documentary is it really does, I believe, solve the riddle of who the, you know, mysterious R.C. Christian was. You know, the guy that went and, you know, paid for the big slabs and have, you know, had them carved out and put the, you know, paid for everything. Very mysterious character. Obviously using a pseudonym of some kind. And so they, you know, this documentary, they go into Elberton, interview, you know, a lot of the people that were physically involved in this. They found the guy who worked at the local bank that did all the transactions, the financial transactions for the Guidestones, this guy, Wyatt C. Martin. Yeah. And apparently this guy, Wyatt C. Martin, was one of the few people that actually knew the true identity of R.C. Christian. And apparently they kept in touch, you know, writing letters back and forth until about 2009. And this banker guy, you know, Wyatt C. Martin, he was sworn to secrecy to never reveal the man's true identity, R.C. Christian. So, you know, the documentary filmmakers actually went to this guy's home and interviewed him. And of course, by this time, he's an old man. And he still said, no, I will not reveal, you know, the name of him. And I'll tell you, you know, some information, though. And long story short, he admitted that he had an old computer case that was literally full of correspondence from R.C. Christian. And so, you know, they convinced the old man to open up the trunk. Like, well, can he just open up the trunk and just, you know, let us see the letters? You know, I know we can't read them, but if you can just open the trunk up and let us see, that'd be cool. So after a little convincing, the old man opens the trunk up. You know, it is a good sized trunk. You know, he bought this. He said it was the first computer he bought. And this is back in the days where, you know, a computer was a fairly large device. You know, so it was like the size of a, you know, medium-sized suitcase. And, you know, it's funny. So he opens it up and they take a couple of screenshots of the letters that are sitting on top. And the old man pulls out one of the letters and says, look, this is one of the letters. I'm not going to let you read it, but this is his handwriting and there's his signature. And so on the screenshot, they managed to capture one of the mailing addresses or the postmark that came from these letters. It was from Fort Dodge, Iowa, of all places. And many of the letters were sent to an address care of Robert Merriman. So yeah, Fort Dodge, Iowa. So anyway, they find out that there was basically two men through this screenshot that were both from Fort Dodge, Iowa. The other guy was Dr. Herbert Karsten, a doctor who, you know, they went and found his headstone at the cemetery in Fort Dodge. And apparently this Robert Kirsten guy had written quite a few articles about overpopulation and the need to conserve nature. And even on his headstone, it said conservationist. So they figured out that, you know, this old banker guy stayed in touch with R.C. Christian until 2009. And that's when the letters quit coming. And it turns out that this Kirsten character, Dr. Kirsten, died in 2009. So they put a bunch of pieces of the puzzle together. And it turns out that this Dr. Herbert Kirsten was the man who actually went to Elberton and did the legwork on constructing the Guidestones. And it turns out that there was a book published by this Robert Christian, Common Sense Renewed, that was published by the publishing company of Robert Merriman in Fort Dodge, Iowa. So these two men were friends. They knew each other. And it looks like Robert Christian was sort of a mixing of the two men's names, Robert Merriman And then Kirsten was sort of an old school word for Christian. So that's how we came up with Robert Christian. And this Common Sense Renewed was a book where he sort of gives us philosophy. And it's in reference to Thomas Paine's book, Common Sense, which called for an age of reason. And for essentially expunging, Christianity from society and replacing it with reason. But what's interesting is, this Kirsten guy wasn't anyone terribly important, a successful doctor, but this Herbert Kirsten was friends with the Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Dr. William Shockley. And this is where it gets interesting, because Dr. William Shockley was a very famous man in certain circles. He was one of the first recruits to work for Bell Labs, and he received the Nobel Prize in Physics. He worked on the transistor, during the war. And later in the 50s, he was the head of the team that invented the semiconductor in Palo Alto. And he's been, known as the man who brought silicon to Silicon Valley. And this William Shockley guy has a lot of deep state connections. I could do a whole show on him. Fascinating character on multiple levels. And there's even a picture of Shockley, covering his left eye. A lot of people say that's a hidden indication that they're part of the Illuminati or the elite, whatever. But that is odd that there's a picture of him covering his left eye. And Shockley, lots of deep state connections. So investigating further into Shockley and maybe who had Shockley, sort of construct the Guidestones, I think that's where it goes next. But it looks like Herbert Kirsten was sort of just the guy that did the legwork to get the monument put up. But Shockley was probably the man that was really behind it. And Shockley was deeply connected to the elite. No question about that. And it's kind of funny. Shockley even donated some sperm to a sperm bank because he was a great believer in eugenics, in the true sense of the word, trying to improve the human, genetic population. And it's kind of funny, Shockley would never have been allowed to be part of society now. And he believed that black people were genetically inferior. And it's kind of funny, donated sperm to a sperm bank that was exclusively for the sperm of geniuses to, create some kind of a super race. Interesting. And, a further indication that Shockley was involved in sort of the, genesis and the behind the scenes planning of the Guidestones was that there's a lot of scientific elements to the Guidestones, like the center stone has an eye level oblique hole that's drilled so the North Star is always visible alongside the slot there. And there's another part of the Guidestones that's always aligned with the sun solstice and equinoxes. And the four slabs are oriented to the limits of the moon migration throughout the year. So this indicates someone that, obviously has some kind of background in science to design all of that. So it's just interesting to see, sometimes things take a strange turn and, the Rothschilds weren't directly behind it and, the usual cast of characters weren't, but the Shockley guy really does connect into the elite parts of the deep state. And, kind of like this Dr. Day character that, gave revelations about the coming system in the New Order of Barbarians tapes. And, you know, one other aspect of the documentary I found interesting was just the fact that, you know, he went back and visited all these players involved in this drama back in 1979, 1980. And of course, by 2015, they were all old men. You know, all the drama had played out. All the self-importance of everybody had sort of faded because, you know, as you get older, you have a different perspective on things. And just seeing how, you know, even the powerful and the rich and the elite, they all get old and die too. So anyway, it's a really good documentary, Dark Clouds Over Elberton. It's worth the time to watch. Even though, you know, at the end of the documentary, it takes an obligatory dive into the Holocaust. Oh, another Holocaust is coming. Oh. But despite that, very interesting thing to watch on multiple levels. And interesting turn at the end there. Oh, someone in Joey Powell saying that Shockley was on William F. Buckley's show. That's interesting. Yeah. And of course, you know, William F. Buckley, another very connected guy, both a Skull and Bones member and a Bohemian Grove member, both, and deeply connected to the CIA. So that's interesting that Shockley was on his show. Interesting, interesting. Well, it's always to see, you know, interesting to see how these pieces of the puzzle add up in the end. You never know how it's going to go, but it does lead back to some very interesting characters. Yeah. Okay, well, that said, I would like to bring on my co-host and my main man, Mr. Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Hey, Giuseppe, how are you, man?
I'm living the dream.
You're living the dream there in D.C., outside of D.C.
Yeah.
In an underground bunker surrounded by the elite.
In the fourth city state recently acknowledged by the U.N., Morningwood, Virginia, which is mask-free, vaccine-free, and Jew-free.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's a nice touch there. And also we have Chris Weinert, also known as Brutal Honesty, and it's certainly time for some Brutal Honesty. Hey, Chris, how are you, man?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Doing good. Doing good, man. I'm hearing a little bit of an echo, though.
Yeah, you want me to drop out, try it again?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
That's cool, man. I don't know if you mentioned the full title of the documentary, Dark Clouds Over Elberton, the true story of the Georgia Guidestones. I researched it, and it is, the whole thing's on YouTube free. And so, as you can buy the DVD, but I'm going to watch that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting just because, you know, you get to see the people firsthand. And also, you know, it's kind of funny, like people were saying, well, Freemasons probably put it up, but I don't think it's quite that simple because obviously there was Freemasons that worked on it because after all, you know, Freemasonry began with stonemasons. But this Shockley character is an interesting twist in the whole thing. And his career was quite amazing.
You know, no doubt.
Inventing the semiconductor, no small feat.
Well, you know, he's described as a difficult and demanding person, but he was a popular lecturer. He had an adventurous nature and enjoyed rock climbing in the Hudson River Valley, which is where my great friends, the Slambovians, live in the Hudson River Valley. That's where West Point is in New York. In fact, he enjoyed hiking so much and was so known for doing it that they named a route discovered by him was called Shockley Ceiling. He was also an amateur magician and loved to plan and execute elaborate practical jokes. And then in later life, in his 60s, he began frequently donating sperm, stating that he hoped to replicate his genius by spreading his genes. So that's where you got where you're doing your weekly deposit, Scorpio. You're following in Shockley's yeah. path. And then, of course, one of the biggest controversies is his work started when he proposed a genetic theory stating that blacks were intellectually inferior to whites because of their genetic structure. It's funny, our own beloved Professor Fetzer wrote a book that shows that the different races are not equal, and it is genetically provable, but the communist, Zionist, hybrid communitarianism wants you to think that we're all equal when it's laughable. But realistically, there's some intensely bright people of every race. I mean, I don't think it's accurate to say blacks are dumb, because I know some genius blacks. I know genius Asians. I know genius everything in my 61 years of interacting with all the various melatonin shades. And so, you know, it's tough when you paint with a broad brush like that. But what's sad here is at the end of life, he became alienated from all colleagues except a few and his wife. He was even estranged from his own children, who learned of his death through the media. So that's great.
Yeah, he felt that his children were genetically inferior to him, because I guess he didn't think his first wife was intelligent enough as for good breeding material. So it's it's a complicated issue, genetics. The idea that genetics don't count is of course a complicated issue. Chris, what are your thoughts on the Georgia Guidestones and Shockley and all this? Where are you going to take this, man?
Oh, well, I can go a million places, but we probably limited on time, so I'll keep it short. I think that R.C. Christian is probably another symbol, a Judeo-Masonic symbol for the Rosicrucians, or this order, this guild that has basically existed throughout empires. They call them just about any name, a brotherhood, an ancient group that really forged the modern religions as we know them, the Judeo-Masonic offerings, and scripted them accordingly to indoctrinate people, I believe. So ultimately, I think this is something that they've always had in store for us, is to use the common man to conquer the frontier in the wilderness. And once that happens, put in their economic sorcery, their magic, and really work these Ivy League schools and these systems managers on humanity in the way that they have. All these guys go to Ivy League schools. All these guys are part of this bloodline. They're all loyal to London. They're all London agents. Shockley, I think, was born in London, right? All these freaking guys are. And all these guys serve different orders. You know, the Whig Party was like basically London loyalists pretending to be American patriots. So this is truly something that we've always been a servant of the British Empire. And now I think we're really going to become a servant of the Chinese Empire through the i.e. London and Israel. So ultimately, I think this is what Jefferson was warning us about with these bankers and ending up homeless on your own homeland if they're allowed to continue. And I think that really that's what they've done with the Federal Reserve, and that's what they've done with the League of Nations, i.e. unto the UN, and really taking us off the gold and silver standards and replacing these things with these intangible fiat currencies in the way they have. You give anybody that kind of advantage over humanity, and they will end up with this breakaway civilization like they're seeing right now. And I think that really the breakaway civilization is playing the caste system, the victims, departmentalizing us against one another in the way that they have. I mean, they're spending trillions of dollars a year to keep us fighting with each other and just killing each other off, or seeing each other as dehumanizing bio warfare threats, or just whatever, right? And ultimately, yeah. Why would they be spending so much money into this type of fear campaign, one side and the other, and doing what they're doing? And then there's people that are really looking into this and trying to stand away from this, and still are getting drawn back into this argument one way or another. And you're seeing figureheads like Trump or Biden kind of assuming the polarizing masses or control of these type of things in form that they always have, where the controlled opposition insiders are, in fact, the offerings that are being presented. And you're seeing even now some of the former insiders going to the other side, not only to establish street credibility, but to establish this long-term perception that they are here to help. But truly, I think they're planted in here to pry open the gates when we least expect it, and let these people in to do what they've always done. Take everything we own and you know, probably wipe us out.
Yeah, good points. And you know, bringing up the London connection is interesting. It's no accident, of course, that you know Shockley was born in London, and you have to wonder, you know, where the true orders came from to create this this monument. Obviously, Dr. Kirsten was just the boots on the ground who had to do the legwork for it. And I'm sure, you know, it's not like they told him, okay, hey, we're in the Illuminati and we want you to make the Georgia Guidestones. It never works like that. They just tell people, you know, enough for them to get the job done. And I'm just curious. Yeah. I want to research deeper into Shockley and more of his connections, because the man that invented the superconductor, I mean, the semiconductor, that is pretty amazing.
He didn't invent it, though. It was just his name. He was a front man, just like Einstein. Many of these other guys are. You know, I mean,
Head of the team that invented it. He ran the team in Palo Alto that invented the semiconductor. But I wouldn't conflate him with Einstein. Einstein was a complete fraud.
I'm not saying he's a fraud. I'm saying that he was in charge of a lot of stuff through, like, the Royal Society, underground through the U.S. military, like Bell Labs. Look at RCA Technicolor or GE. These are also offerings that are pretty much the same structural blueprint, where they use these educational institutions for, like, the slave labor of the student loans and the kids on student loans, and then pretty much turn them out into to operatives into the deep state, or the contractors for the deep state. And these are where these things start to be built in at. This is what becomes the Leviathan that we know now as the deep state. And Bell Laboratories is one of the fronts for this. And I would have to say, without question, along with RCA Techno Chronovisor, whatever that thing was, the Technicolor, they were working on things like the Chronovisor. I'd also say that Marconi was another one that was used in such a manner through RCA and many other things. This is a European aristocracy that is using a secret society and these American shabgoys as frontmen. And I just think that's more what Shockley would be in terms of not being an American patriot, but somebody who's more of an agent to London. And that's what I'm kind of suggesting. These guys need people like that out there in front of this. Carnegie would be another one. I mean, there's so many that have just created the culture, the educational institutions, everything in terms of this type of development and have harnessed it for this very elite few. BlackRock and Blackstone would be another example of some of these things.
Yeah. And you know, there's another theory that the semiconductor was developed from alien technology from the Roswell crash. I forget the name of the guy, Colonel Corso, I think was his name, that wrote the book on that theory. So who knows how this all went down. But this guy was right in the middle of it. And he was actually one of the very first recruits to work for Bell Labs. When Bell Labs first came online. So that's interesting. This guy was involved in the production of technology since the very beginning of the 20th century.
Think about how much money has been taken out from the Pentagon and from the HUD and from all these programs, the deep state. What are they, Castaneda and Fitz and Skidmore found like $150 trillion total if you count all the embezzled funds. This is a complete and total racket, a dispossession thing that they're using taxpayer funding with and then taking the rewards, the profits, not only suppressing our wages, but taking this type of black market deep state skunkworks projects and building these type of technologies. Look at these guys. They're all living to be 100 years old. We're living to be 60 if we're lucky. Are you kidding me? You know, this is they are pretty much holding technology as far as we know it and then blaming us for shit like carbon emission while they fly around in charter jets and put their fat fingers in our chest about this type of stuff. And they're the ones that created and ran this racket for a solid century in the first place. You know, so how they really absolve themselves and put the accountability on the common man once again is to me a mystery. But how the common man bears this burden and accepts this as the programming that they're given in terms of binary indoctrination, this to me seems to be a magic trick in itself, and I just don't understand it. You know, I mean, I know we're all guilty and part of it, but you know, these are the guys that are quote unquote leaders that will not allow competition because it's a sin. They will not allow innovation unless they harness it and selectively release it to the market. So what do we really do in the face of this? What do we do with sound investment when they manipulate all markets? You know, I mean,
that's and of course Marconi ripped off a lot of research from Tesla. Yeah, and Marconi was another mysterious character. We should do a show on him sometime.
All these guys are brotherhood.
Yeah, exactly. No question. Giuseppe, what's your take on the Georgia Guidestones and the fact that it all leads to Fort Dodge, Iowa, of all places?
Well, I look forward to watching that documentary. I've been to the Georgia Guidestones, and it is a creepy place. It's interesting.
You've been to it?
Oh, yeah. Several years ago, yeah.
What was that like? What was the vibe like there, man?
Well, the vibe is creepy. It's definitely malevolent intent. It doesn't have like an energy that makes you feel good. And but it doesn't. I mean, the idea
I believe you.
That
there was a lot of people murdered at that site. It was a Cherokee battle in the 1810s or 20s. Jackson and them guys just wiped out tons of people over there, just so you know.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah. There's definitely, in fact, really graceful. I watched her little documentary about apparently there's blood on top of some of those granite stones. So perhaps there was some type of sacrifice done at some point right on the guide stones themselves. But it's pretty wild that I look forward to reading that documentary. I'm watching it, rather. And the other thing that you guys are talking about is this whole carbon farce, the Green New Steel. It's like if ever it was proven that man is having a negative impact but a minor one on the planet, it was 15 months ago when they instituted their fear porn worldwide lockdown, and within 2 weeks the canals at Venice cleared, there were animals moving into the cities. You know, the air was clear. I mean, the earth can heal itself really quickly. And
plant more trees.
Right. You know? Exactly.
They never hear that from these guys, right?
Yeah. Sorry, how about Operation Johnny Appleseed, man, you know?
Yeah. Jonathan, man. Yeah. So this is just another huge scam by these demonic, satanic plutocrats. And they're, they're serving a dark god that isn't, our God, that's for sure.
No, no question. And I just found it interesting too to see to actually see these people interviewed in 2015 and how they all old men now. And it's such a reminder of all of our, mortality and how, all the drama and the self-importance ends up fading over time. And ultimately you're an old man, no matter how high up the pyramid you go. And I think that's one of the things that, made that documentary fascinating to me.
That's what Skull and Bones is all about too. You know, these guys know that you pretty much have a mortal life and you have to pass it on to generations. That's how you pretty much triumph, the human existence. It is pretty much your memory survives. And that's why anybody that doesn't go along with the official narrative is pretty much never commissioned in terms of art or culture or published or anything. You know, they're run out into obscurity, into poverty, things like this. It's not an accident. These guys pretty much control the narrative, and this is how and why. So people wonder how they get away with these type of things. They really control the information at all avenues. And you can see this now with technocracy and how they position themselves in terms of these spigots of informations and flows of them. So they can turn them on or turn them off at any place and really control the narrative. And better yet, to understand through accumulation of our data, what we know, what we believe, what our thoughts are, what we're going to do next. You know, I mean, this is a wet dream for a tyrant, you know? I mean, like, I can't believe that humanity is not only giving this stuff away, but they're allowing the new constitution to become the Georgia Guidestones, you know? It's sick.
It's just a very interesting thing. It's very pertinent given what we're living through now. And I want to get both your guys' thoughts on this, breaking news that, Pfizer is actually seeking full approval of their vaccine. And obviously it's a done deal or they wouldn't be broadcasting it, but they're already dropping the hints that, hey, this opens the door. Now we can require the vaccines for, to work or this or that. Giuseppe, why don't you go first? What are your thoughts on that? And where do you think it leads us in terms of the future of our civilization?
I think we have a bleak future where we're literally going to be the breakaway rebels who are trying to survive, and literally the predictive programming of the last 20 years of all these zombie movies and zombie TV shows like The Walking Dead. I mean, the idea that these morons are taking this injection to get their normal life back, that is never coming back, as I described in my intro for yesterday's show. And the idea that one of the devastating impacts of this radical experimentation with genetic tampering, where they don't really know what they're doing, and proof was how they thought they understood genetic manipulation of Roundup Ready corn, and oh, it'll never they lied about saying how the yields would be better when in reality, Roundup crops are 30 to 40% less yield than organic and natural farming. And that'll never spread. And within 2 years, the horizontal gene spread had turned 26 weeds and other fields into Roundup resistant weeds and super weeds. And so now they're doing this, and it's literally just a huge satanic experiment, a huge population culling, and it's going to be so bizarre. I mean, it's going to start very simply with, like, watch for the increase in auto accidents, watch for people doing stupid things in stores, and it's going to come on slowly as this protein spike builds in the fools who took this injection. It's supposedly takes 3 to 18 months to develop. So you've got like a two-pronged attack. You know, the shock to the system of many kills them instantly or within a few days. Hence the fact that, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 150,000 to 250,000 people have already been killed by these this experimental deadly injection. But the next wave, when that protein spike builds in them, is going to be absolutely catastrophic. And it apparently is going to be spread not only by breathing, but also by touch. So essentially, the internationalist Jew has created the ultimate bioweapon, the normie fool who listens to the mass media, trusts the government, trusts Big Pharma, trusts Bill Gates, trusts Tony Fauci, and it's going to be the demise of most of civilization.
Chris, go ahead. We've got just a couple minutes. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick. Giuseppe, you make some great points there. You know, the GMO thing that maybe you could even add to your point a little bit on is the health effects that it has on human consumption as well as livestock consumption,
right?
And even the cancer rates that follow these type of things, as well as the obesity rates that have followed these type of food programs that have been imposed on most of these countries by the CIA and the intelligence agencies destroying through the banking institutions most of these farmers and forcing them into these IMF conditioned loans that include GMO production in the 90s when they crashed the peso and Soros and them guys come in with their NGOs. So I'm just saying, these are the same guys behind the Monsanto offering, never held accountable, never even looked at in terms of media for like the heart disease. 1,700 people die every day from this stuff. Not even talking about this, right? Not even a conversation, not even on the table for discussion. So anybody that does talk about this is giving you medical misinformation. I'd have to say that if this is misinformation, let's have a conversation. Let's go over the data and let's see where it goes from there.
Yeah, well, all I know is I'm not taking the shot. And, you know,
GMO.
The LTC Rolt made a good point in the chat on Twitch that it was always a losing strategy to refuse the jab because it wasn't approved. Of course, they have to make it look like we're in the process of approving it. We don't know if it's if we're going to approve it. We'll have to see. The experts have to have some more
all
meetings.
These fatalities are from COVID. You got to go get vaxxed. The people that are getting vaxxed are the reason these fatalities are happening. That's what they're actually telling these numbskulls, and they're buying this bullshit.
Yep,
and right. They're on the other side telling us the other side that you're saying, Dave. So they are definitely doing a polarized targeting on both sides to trigger everybody, no doubt.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a good point. And the point I was trying to make, too, is that, you know, they have to make this illusion that we're going through a process here where in reality it was all scripted. It was all pre-planned. And they just have to unveil it slowly so it looks like we're going through this process and we live in a democracy and blah, 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 blah.
Like an organic development, no doubt. And it's grass turf all day.
Here, this is a perfect example. A 48-year-old plastic surgeon in Ohio is dead. Dr. Thomas Flanagan received the first dose of experimental Moderna mRNA January 6, according to his Facebook page. He received a second dose February 3rd. He mocked those who are skeptical, saying the microchip is working fine. My mind is slowly being taken over by the hive mind. We are just fine. And then he went and continued on and wrote his mock obituary, and it killed him.
Oh, well, proof has.
Yep.
Okay, welcome back to hour number two of Operation Scorpio. And this hour, we're going to really shift here. And we're going to bring on a panel of highly intelligent, insightful people. First off, we're going to have the rebel madman himself, Mike Gaddy, along with Daryl Wayne, the retired pilot, and a man who believes that words have meaning, and another very intelligent man, and a man of great wisdom. And also, we're going to bring on a good friend of Mike Gaddy, who was a guest on his show this last Sunday, Dale from Salt Lake City. So let's see if we got everybody connected. Maybe Mike, are you there?
Yes, but I'm obviously on the wrong show. You mentioned intelligent people.
Okay, we'll have to make some adjustments there. Daryl, are you there, sir?
Yeah, I'm standing by here and looking forward to the show. Hello, everybody.
Howdy.
Okay, and Dale on.
You're sounding loud and clear.
Oh, wow, this is great. No technical problems. We got everybody hooked up. Excellent. Well, Dale, let's start with you just because a lot of people probably aren't familiar with you. You're outside of Salt Lake City somewhere. Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to research this kind of information.
Well, I was a listener to KTalk Radio, which went into the talk format probably second to I can't remember the oldest talk format station in the country, but the KTalk had the reputation of being the second oldest, going over to talk in like 1965. I was a casual listener, frequent listener to the station, and was having coffee with a friend one time. He said, "You know, you ought to go down there and volunteer and be a call screener or a producer sometime." And I did that, and then one thing led to another. I had no background in broadcasting, or, you know, my education was certainly not along those lines. But I ended up getting into a sequence where I became a host and did about 12 years with some interruptions at this station, KTKK, that is in the middle of Salt Lake Valley. Basically had a electronic footprint of about a million and a half people, depending on the weather conditions, and got to know a lot of people and had quite a run there. Of course, it was a learning experience for me, you know, unparalleled in my life, and led me down the rabbit hole much, much farther than I would have gone otherwise. Anybody that's in radio knows that's you're basically getting an education by doing your show prep every day. And it led me to a point where I was no longer really suitable for terrestrial broadcast, if you know what I mean, because commercial stations have a set of unwritten rules and places you can't go, and I found I had to go there. I'm sure everybody on the panel today understands perfectly what I'm saying, that we live under a strict speech code, even though it may not be codified in law quite yet. It's almost as strict as it is in Europe and Canada when you really talk about what happens on the ground. So I'm out of that business, but I'm delighted to be here today with you guys and you know, reprise some of those topics that cannot be mentioned.
Yeah. And Dale, was there a particular subject that sort of made you part ways with terrestrial radio, or you know, how did that sort of go down for you?
Well, I think there were two tracks. One is the you know, the when you begin to turn over rocks every other day or so in preparation for a radio program, you begin to notice a pattern of control in this country, that there's a tight control. Our elected representatives answer to an entity that has different names. Zionist is the sanitized name for it. Jewish supremacy, the Israelis, the bankers. There's all kinds of euphemisms for it. And that it is essentially the financial matrix that runs the Western world and has tremendous control over the rest of the world as well. To what degree, I don't know. But certainly the Western world is under a tight discipline. Our wars, our foreign policy in particular, conforming perfectly to the will of these people. And when you start talking about that on a terrestrial radio station, on a commercial radio station, you immediately get into a very rarefied category of human being. I mean, I was told that by somebody that there was one woman in Georgia who went by the handle of Georgia Peach, and myself and possibly Jeff Rentz on some of his terrestrial outlets, and we were the last of the breed. I don't know if that's true, but certainly on the internet you can still get a lot of discussion about the Jewish power structure, what the old timers used to call organized world Jewry, which is a very nasty term, you know, in the world of PC. But yeah, that's what you're talking about. Now there's another layer here in Utah. We have this is a boss hog state par excellence, and the boss hog is called the Mormon Church. And they're, to my mind, in many respects, an arm of this new world order, this world revolutionary movement. Somewhere along the lines, the Mormon Church very evidently has switched over to conforming with the great reset that we're going through. And I would criticize them to some extent, but in truth, in my broadcast, I would try to avoid that subject more or less in order to get at the greater evil. And both of these subjects were seen as very unpleasant, very bad form by the owners of my particular outlet, my station. And we just got, there's just a sort of an alienation that grew up over that. And we eventually parted ways. So, and that was fine, you know, because the fact of the matter is that you're not going, most people under the sound of your voice in this part of the country can't really assimilate. They're so, they've been segregated so long from the facts about who runs our foreign policy, who our elected representatives actually have to answer to. They actually used to have a written document they'd have to sign, a pledge. I'm sure you know about that. You start talking about this, and it kind of bounces off of people here in the Wasatch Front. They don't have the context to assimilate it, and it probably is better to work through the internet on those subjects, because you're banging your head against the wall to a great extent.
Yeah, and to the average person that hasn't researched the topic, it sounds like hate speech. And Dan, I just want to thank you for coming on. This is going to be an excellent show. And you know, I've met so many quality people through Mr. Mike Gaddy, including Daryl. And so, Mike, can I get your take on the Georgia Guidestones? I don't know if you heard the last hour, but you know, it looks like the whole thing kind of goes back to this guy William Shockley from Fort Dodge, Iowa, of all places. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I would like to thank Dale for including the fact that he interviewed me a few times on his show, which I'm sure did not increase his popularity there at all. And then I also remember the morning that Dale and I and a few other folks had breakfast with Clive and Bundy, which was an interesting morning. But good friend and a very true patriot is my friend Dale Williams. So I just wanted to say those things about him. The Georgia Guidestones, I was there just a few months ago, went there. I got a lot of pictures. I had done some research. And along those lines, I agree with you. It was a very unusual set of circumstances, how this guy comes in and wants all this stuff done. But to be totally candid, I really haven't given a lot of thought. I wanted to see the Georgia Guidestones. I was disappointed in what I saw. I took some pictures, there were maybe 5-6 people there when I was there. I had been there one time previously years ago, but I don't know. Guys, you're going to probably have to fill in my blank spaces on the Georgia Guidestones.
Okay, interesting. What was the vibe like there when you went there? How did it feel being there? Was it creepy or neutral or?
Well, I felt like I was somewhere in northern Georgia, just right across the line from South Carolina. It was, and that is creepy sometimes in itself. But I didn't get any real strange vibes, anything like that. I didn't. I've had much stronger vibrations standing on the battle on the Gettysburg battlefield at 3 a.m.
Oh yeah, Daryl, what are your thoughts on the Georgia Guidestones and the, leading back to Fort Dodge, Iowa? This is Dr. Shockley.
Yeah, Fort Dodge, Iowa. That's not far from where I was raised as a young boy. The Georgia Guidestones. Let's see. That would be the American Stonehenge, would it not be? And all that is a outward statement and a symbol, a symbology of the oldest religion in the world, pre-Christian, pre-Moses, all of that, which was the fertility sex cult that we now know as Chris. So I have to say this, Chris, brilliantly laid out in the previous hour, all the esoteric connections and interlocking directories of the secret societies, which can fall under just one name. In whatever iteration and derivation they manifest themselves, they like to rebrand themselves, it's Freemasonry, period. And that's 1,000 points of lights, by the way. So that's all that is. It's just symbology. They're trying to make a little statement there, and it's the fertility sex cult. You know, they worship the stone penis and the vice capesa and all the symbology, and you see it manifest all over DC and Rome and the city of London. So I mean, I don't know how much more obvious they got to make it, but hey, you know, for the people that aren't interested in knowing anything, take a shot, you know, get an injection. So
no big deal. Yeah,
you know, it'll go away. It'll go away soon. You know, really. Just relax, Norm and Norma Jean. Just relax. Go ahead. Believe what you want to. It'll all just lay down. Relax. It'll all be over soon. You won't have to worry about it. You know, is that bad? You know, they're sorting themselves out. You know, yeah.
That shot or the jab is going to end up being a hell of a demographic filter, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an aggregator. Yeah, right. Darwin. Yeah, where's can somebody start working on the bell curve? I want to see it. I want to see the bell curve. So.
I wonder if the Guidestones are not. My understanding about the religion of this Judeo-Masonic thing that Daryl is referencing, one of the real keystone items in that belief system is that you must telegraph pretty clearly what you're about to do to your victims. Have you heard that, Daryl, that's important?
Oh yeah,
that not just kind of a ritual, but that they believe that it's really incumbent upon them, and the serpent that lives in the tree that you know is at the top of the power pyramid, that is their god, requires them to almost get the sanction or at least the acquiescence of their victims by saying, "Hey, I'm about to do this to you," and then you do it. And yeah, and we hear that a lot. Yeah. And maybe that's what the Guidestones are about saying, "Well, we're about to wipe you out." So
what you're referencing is part of their religious ritual of how they understand is karma. They are interested in karma, and they aren't atheists. They have a god, and it's Lucifer. I have their books. I have 3,000 occulted and esoteric books. I have read it in print. Okay, so I go to like this is why Mike and I get along so great is I go for the source documents. And because I like to rebut opinions with source documents. But, yeah, so it's karma, and they believe in Lucifer, and that's their religion. And you can't be in Masonry if you're an atheist. They see atheists. I mean, you can be a tool, but you can't be a made man in the club if you're an atheist. And they're not against Hinduism. They're not against all these other forms of God worship. And they just have an axe to grind with Christianity. That's the axe they grind. So,
Daryl, you're absolutely rereading E. Michael Jones' book, "The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit." And one thing that's very interesting that he points out is, just like you said, you can still be a Jew in good standing if you become a Hindu or if you become a Buddhist. That's really not a big deal. The across the line is if you become a Christian. And I found that statement.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, they wouldn't hate you. They wouldn't hate you, or they wouldn't hate the belief system and philosophy, if you will, the reality of Christianity, if it wasn't true. Well, I mean, the one thing that the people of Christianity who call themselves Christian, who call him by their name, his name, and the worshipers of Lucifer, is that they all agree that he's real. That's the one thing they agree on, all right? And they hate him.
Yeah,
and they hate you.
I'll mention the snake god that lives in the tree. That really is the god of the Talmudic Jews. Name they call it. They don't call it Lucifer, but that's essentially what it is.
You guys mind if I jump in here? Or you guys want to?
Please. Please, Chris, please.
I think that this whole thing is an offering of the Judeo-Masonic order. This is what they basically had to put out when they exhausted their credibility in Rome. When they had the Bar Kokhba and the whole temple revolts, the 70 AD one, all that stuff when they crashed Nero out. When these Jewish mentors and bankers basically ran that empire into the ground, they moved on to the next one. And they had to put a new offering for the common man, and that was Christianity. And I agree, they definitely do want to keep the Jews from joining into these groups or from merging into this. It's almost like they do with the Mormons or any of these other departmentalized faiths. These are religious operatives that are being weaponized by this Judeo-Masonic cult. If you look at like the Vatican and who formed it, if you look at who wrote the early Christian text, the New Testament in theory, most of them are either translated by Saint Jerome or coming out of Alexandria, or most of them are from Jewish scholars putting this narrative out there. So I don't know if the Jews come in and control Christianity early on and offer the Vatican, but somewhere along the line, they've hijacked the faith in the 300-500s and have this this just type thing on through the Vatican and have used this kind of thing to run Christianity for a long, long time, or at least to put a brotherhood in there. And like every century, they could put a new brotherhood or a new offering, you know, the Dominican, the Jesuits,
well,
as the other.
Chris,
so that's my theory on Chris, that. What are your thoughts?
I would take what you said and say that that's all, from my study and experience, it's unrebuttable. what you're saying is unrebuttable. I mean, you can disagree with what somebody could disagree with you, but I don't think they could rebut you with based upon the facts. So it's ugly.
PW, I mean, you see how they indoctrinate people and turn them into like better victims. And I think at some point in time, God's will would actually be not to turn the other cheek, but to smack the fuck out of these guys, you know?
Well, that's one way to put it. I'll give you a really good example that, you know, supports and correlates with what, you know, you just said, Chris, was with Cyrus Schofield and John Darby through Zionism, working to bring in the Schofield Reference Bible, the mythology of a rapture and dispensationalism that only serves a Zionist agenda in the future. That was the latest, from my point of view, as Christianity goes, that was the latest and greatest iteration of exactly what you were talking about of infiltration. Everything for thousands of years has been infiltrated. It's all been infiltrated, you know.
Add to that, you know, the players in the Bible, the characters have been turned around backwards about who their real identity is, but that's the subject for another time. Giuseppe, jump in. Where do you want to take this, man?
Well, I mean, Dale left out one of the greatest descriptions of our enemy, the internationalist Jew, by the great Henry Ford. And I would say, you know, basically the Jewish Satanists, the Talmudic satanic chicken swingers, they're a cancer upon this world. They're a true malignancy. And like all cancer, they're quite effective at winnowing their way in to any seat of power and effectively taking it over. I mean, look at how it's only 110 years ago that Rothschild fixer Samuel Untmeyer paid a disgruntled, outcast British low-level society porch climber Cyrus Schofield to rewrite the Bible and take and essentially make the Satanist Jew the chosen people. And it's just insane that you now have Christian Zionists, evangelical Christian Zionists. That's like saying you have fire water. It's just, well, actually, that's a nickname for alcohol. You have like summer, winter at the same time. They're so non-mutually, and yet you have these people say Judeo-Christian, the controlled media. Oh, Judeo-Christian values. I share no values with any satanic Jew, none whatsoever. And so it's just insane what's going on. And Normie and Norma sheeples, they drink that stuff up like all you free beer at a bar, and they're constantly you know, labeling all of us as anti-Semites and haters. Oh, it makes me feel so bad. It hits me in the feels.
Well, where's Michael at?
Yeah, Mike, you jump in.
Well, I was sitting here sobbing for Giuseppe. Giuseppe, you hit my heartstrings, buddy. I feel so bad, but my gosh, you guys are just right on. And you hit the nail on the head. We are duped from all angles. I was just recently reading, Daryl, you're probably familiar with I was trying to think of his first name. The last name was the Manning, was the black guy who was a member of the Communist Party in America, and then figured out what was going on and wrote a book about it. And then guess what? He suddenly died. So he went into detail how these people have infiltrated the churches of the especially of the South and the Negro, how they have infiltrated the churches. So it goes back to that age-old adage. If you want to control the opposition, you must lead the opposition. And yeah. It's all a false narrative.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, give you an example of exactly what Giuseppe and Mike are talking about in our present moment experience, even over the last 8 years, the last 2 months. You have this thing called the Republican Party versus the Democrat Party, and that's exactly what that is. That's just Republicans are controlled opposition. If there wasn't one, the Democrats would have to invent the Republican Party in order to have this cognitive dissidence. See, look, the Republican Party are just your emotional groomers. They groom you into accepting what the agenda is. Okay, they're like political pedophiles. Okay, you think they're there to help you? They're just there to groom you into accepting what the agenda is and move you along. So it's listen, the conservatives haven't won anything in 100 years. Okay, nothing, zero, score zero. And they have perfected the ability to lose in slow motion while keeping you in hope. And that was their job. That's their job. So,
well, hey, have you guys ever heard of Robert L. Dabney?
Yeah.
Well, I thought you had DW, but you other guys, have you heard of Robert L. Dabney?
No.
Give us more. What do you got?
Okay, Robert L. Dabney was Stonewall Jackson's chief of staff. He was a Presbyterian minister, and he perfectly defined the Republican Party in 1868. Now, that's a few years back, but here's what he had to say. It's not very long, but I challenge anyone to convince me that he didn't nail the Republicans of that era and the Republicans of this era perfectly.
He said, Mike, you mentioned him last week, by the way, just as a testament to the Alzheimer's that's operating here.
Okay,
me
well,
being the most advanced case.
Yeah. Well, see, some people have CRS. I have CRAFT. So
are you going to tell us what that stands for?
Can't remember a frickin' thing.
Okay, yeah. There you go. See, I'm writing it down. Go ahead, because I'll forget it otherwise.
Right. So here is what Dabney had to say about the wonderful Republican conservatives. He said, the conservatism is a party which never conserves anything. Its history has been that it demurs to each aggression of the progressive party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but always acquiesces at last in the innovation. What was the resisted novelty of yesterday is today one of the accepted principles of conservatism. It is now conservative only in affecting to resist the next innovation, which will tomorrow be forced upon its timidity and will be succeeded by some third revolution to be denounced and then adopted in its turn. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward toward perdition, unquote. Is that not the Republican Party?
Isn't it ironic that a parliamentary system, which supposedly is inferior, and our system is a product development from, an advancement from, a parliamentary system actually offers more organic potential to resist this thing you're describing, this controlled opposition, because of the multi-party and coalition sort of arrangements that have to be made to form a government. I always chuckle at that, because this system we have absolutely greased the way for capturing the opposition party, and then the whole system is captive at that point.
Yeah, that's a great point, Dale.
They probably do it the same everywhere if you really think about it. You know, they put this controlled opposition dialogue everywhere they go. Look how they ran like the Russian Revolution, the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks, or even now with, you know, the Republicans and the Democrats. They all work towards One Belt, One Road Israel and you know, the UN agenda, whether we like it or not. So really, it's just different means to the same end.
And didn't Bolshevik and Menshevik, maybe somebody can freshen me up on this, Menshevik meant majority and Bolshevik more or less meant the smaller party. Is that
no?
Is that
it's the
correct?
Opposite. It's the opposite. Bolsheviks the majority, Mensheviks yeah. the minority.
Okay, and so obviously the Bolsheviks got the upper hand. At least that's what we're taught. And is Menshevik associated more with Trotsky and the expulsion of Trotsky and all of that? Was there actually a power struggle there?
Can I provide you something that might be helpful to look into as well? Is that Lenin and Kerensky have the same teacher? Kerensky's father trained them both. These guys are operatives, and I think most cases they're working for, you know, different departmentalized operations in the same place and working towards mm-hmm. the same goal, like I say. And I think that will be more of a better approach to maybe look at history instead of getting mm-hmm. down the rabbit holes that they try to spin you down. Maybe think about
right.
the big picture and help you cut through the BS a little more.
Yeah, I mean, they want us to believe that Trotsky was, you know, the party that was run out of town. But I noticed that University of Chicago, that whole node, is a change agent factory. Those people are Trotskyites. So. Yeah. Who really got the axe in the head? I don't know. It's you know, they becloud everything.
Well, yeah, and the Trotskyites weren't run out of the communist Soviet Union until Stalin. Apparently Trotsky, you know, died in Mexico City. Was apparently assassinated in Mexico City.
Yeah, okay.
So that's a fascinating little aspect, and you're totally right. This is where the neocons come from, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah, I would also just throw another thing out, not to overcomplexify the conversation. It's absolutely riveting, by the way. I would be happy to be just a listener to this, and I'm very glad to know where you guys are on the internet and see the link here in front of me. For future reference, but I'm curious because at least a couple of you and possibly three of you have drilled way down into this subject. There is a model that a lot of folks who study the Jewish power structure believe in and promote, and that is that there is a schism in Jewry and two main factions. And one faction being sort of represented by Chicago and or University of Chicago, and the other pole being maybe New York City or Tel Aviv, depending on, you know, what name you want to hang on it. But one is a Zionist priority global order, one world order, and the other one is a one world order priority, one world order. In other words, one emphasizes global socialism at all costs and the consolidation of government on the globe. The other one wants that too, but wants to have the Zionist agenda, which is has territorial ambitions in the region of Israel and dominance over there, wants to keep that heritage. And the former believes that that's baggage and an unnecessary drag on the world revolutionary movement. Do any of you want to comment on that supposed schism, and is it real?
Well, I'll jump in real quick. There's some friends of the show, Larick from Texas, Brian and Jenna, the Nordica, and Nikki Rapana, and they've identified that what's really going on is something called communitarianism, which has been is a complete hybrid merging of the two supposed separate poles, that being Zionism and communism. And my personal research tells me that they've never really been that separate. They're all controlled by the Rothschild banking cabal and the dark spiritual leadership at that level. What do you want to call it? The Phoenicians, the Canaanites, the Hidden Hand, whatever they're going by now, the Illuminati. So I think that's an artificial dichotomy.
Yeah. You're talking about one world. You're talking about a one world authority in both cases. I mean, there's tremendous overlap. I've always been dubious that you could actually call it a schism myself.
Well, Gerald, I heard you. Go ahead.
The example of what you're talking about in the controlled opposition at that level, I believe that the theater of that is real, or it's presented to people. And how is it presented to people in your day-to-day life that you can't identify? Norm and Norma Jean can't identify it. It's the neoliberal progressive Marxist, those liberal socialist BLM antifas, and then we have the neocon. Okay, those wonderful conservative Jews. Okay, so this is also your dialectic or your opposites, your controlled opposition. Previously, I just said it's a Democrat versus Republican. That's the controlled opposition. So what you're talking about is at a more esoteric level, society level inside of Judaism. I would agree with Giuseppe in that they all spring from the same source. And I say that because they all share in their rituals and cult. Which is both sides. Okay, if you identify a schism in Jewry, they all share their sacraments, which is Sabbatean Frankism. Okay, they're all pedophile. Okay, or at those levels, right? They all participate. Whether they're Epstein, okay, he was a priest in their Sabbatean Frankist temple, right? And you had participants from either side of this so-called schism. So I say it's another one of the false dialectics, and it's part of the theater. So just my point of view.
And yet, there does appear to be differences. I get the sense that a significant part of the cabal really wants the United States to cave in and to be to get rid of the last vestiges of sovereignty, or even the appearance of sovereignty. That's probably the better way to put it, because there isn't any sovereignty. And the Zionist faction is interested in keeping the brand United States alive so that it can keep the military of the United States coherent as a weapon against its resistant populations in Islam and what have you. Do you see where I'm going with that? That there does appear to be a disagreement about how to proceed with the United States, and yet they both want the white order on this continent completely destroyed and the liquidation ultimately of the white population. So maybe it's a matter of tempo more than anything and timing, but I do sense that there are strains of this thing. There is some factionalism going on here.
Yeah. And I always kind of, relate it to sort of like, a mafia war. It's just a matter of jostling.
Yeah. The
seat gets to be at the top seat. But they're still aligned in a way, but they're just fighting over who's going to sit on the big chair, so to speak. Mike, what's your take on this schism or no schism?
Well, it's an interesting dialogue, an interesting examination to really delve into. And I don't see where most people would see it if we pointed it out to them. Again, you know, as my grandfather used to tell me, it's a real hard job to pour water in a jug that has a lid on it. And the American public, the most of the people that I meet have had that lid on their jar, and they have made sure that it doesn't loosen for any logic or reasoning. So, sometimes you think you're trying to talk to people, and we've all run into this where the people who believe that their opinion is trumps, and I don't mean that in the Donald fashion, but their opinion trumps fact. And we have educated a mass of people to this, to where we are now, I think people keep saying, and I don't want to contradict them, but the people keep saying, well, can America be saved? America was gone a long time ago. You know, we're just looking at the remnants the shell collapses of what people think it ought to be or think it was. But I don't see any recovery for this whatsoever without divine intervention.
Yeah.
The Rubicon a long time.
I'm sorry.
Trying to get in. I agree with a lot of what you guys are saying. I'm going to have to say that I think there is a schism that is a manufactured optic. It's like the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, the Montagues and the Capulets, the Rosicrucians, the War of the Roses, the Yorks and the Lancasters. You can go into the Yorks, to the Tories and the Whigs as well, and even how it manifests into the two-party systems in America and polarizes the people in accordance to rhetoric, not necessarily in terms of deliverance at all. So this is really how they run the theater, the gambit, through emotion, through fear, through hope. You know, they understand the human beliefs structures and how they can manipulate people by these motifs more so than actually directly enslaving them is you give them hope, or you allow them to really think they're doing something for the greater good of an ethos, a pathos, or a logos. And ultimately, these are things that Aristotle talked about 2,300 years ago or more. So this is certainly not a new concept. These guys, these empire makers, they are a brotherhood that have really created just about every empire that we know or that we've ever heard of in terms of human history. So I really have to say that there's something there with that. And really, I think that all these four corners of the earth, whether you're talking the partition of Babylon or any of these existing empires, at some point in time were influenced by this brotherhood, this occult sect. And there might be even a schism in that between like the serpent and the eagle. It might be just, you know, one and the same. They might be the complementary sources for each other, you know, the circle of life, the yin and yang. So I do think there is a dualism that is exploited not only in religion, but in mankind. And they understand how to provoke people by these emotions. And this is part of their magic. And they do it with economics as well as religion and politics. Well,
oh, you took the words right out of my mouth. The literally was about to reference the yin and yang based on the brilliant recitation that you just executed. Another way of saying it is dialectic. They have a dialectic that's shedding off subordinate dialectics, you know, constantly. And so they have this, and even their core, some of their core documents talk about autodynamism as a theory of how everything is generated in nature, in material, dialectical materialism, that nature is powered by the fact that every system, right down to the irreducible scale, has two components, and those two components in opposition to one another create a dynamic. So yeah, autodynamism, I didn't make up the term by any means, but it's there again and again, and it's very hard for a goy brain you know, somebody with European or Northern European wiring to even get your mind wrapped around this. It's just such alien territory. Maybe it's too sophisticated for us guys that just like to chop wood and go fishing. I don't know, you know. Anyway.
Kind of divorce yourself emotionally from it. That's really the biggest thing. Is, you know, as a Lions fan in Detroit, it's helped me really dissociate emotionally from certain things that I should care about in theory, right? You know, so, I mean, this is of the many things that if you have that belief structure or that indoctrination into you, and of course they can get that on you at an early age and really force you into accepting their system instead of your own experiences with God or with humanity or whatever, then ultimately they want you to do that and embrace that as the way, the truth. And you know, that's really the devil's in the details with a lot of that, because they do put a lot of truth in there. And like you were talking about earlier, you know, with the devil's contract, they do have to give you some sort of a way out or a truth or a revelation of what they're doing to you. And I think that that's really in like things like the Bible and some of their, you know, prospectus, we'll just say, in terms of their offerings.
Giuseppe, why don't you jump in, man? Go ahead.
This is just a fascinating discussion. I wonder, should we get to the revolution of 18, or plural, revolutions of 1848 that we were intent upon discussing?
Oh, definitely. I definitely want to get into that, but why don't we wait till the top of the hour, only because we've only got about 10 minutes, and because the revolution 1848 is going to take us to a whole hour of conversations, because it's so important. And I think it was actually Dale that brought it up on Mike's show this previous Sunday. So I don't know, maybe we should just jump into it now. It's such a great topic.
Hey, Dale, Dave, can I ask Chris a question first?
Sure.
Chris, you mentioned the opposition party in American history. And we know that in Federalist Number 10 that James Madison wrote extensively about the factions and how we had to control the factions, which is, you know, nothing but a sales job. But why do you, or who do you think started the opposition party in American history?
Oh, wow. Well, I think it's really a controlled offering. I think they run a lot of gambits like this between like the French and the English in terms of settling the frontier. You know, they send the English in to negotiate or trade with the Indians, and then they start some sort of provocation, blame it on the French. And next thing you know, those Indians hate the French. They form two divisions of Indians, you know, the Wabanaki and the Iroquois, and they form two confederations, two legal systems, and really start to dispossess them in such a manner. And ultimately, they use, you know, a lot of these people through this two-party dialogue, whether it's in wars or anything for that matter, in the same way. It's part of an exploitation of binary psychology, and I think that that's really why they do it. I couldn't necessarily say who came up with this idea. I mean, Hegel was coming up with this around the 1700s, so I would have to think that you know, some of these concepts of like the Hegelian dialectic control opposition dialogues would probably be not a new concept. It'd be something these guys have been working on for a long time. And it almost seems like they seem to cycle history in like to the century and to the date. You know, you think about the 30 Years' War, 1418 to 1448, same with 1618 to 1648, 1717 wars of Austrian succession, 1812, the Napoleonic Wars, World War One, you know, World War Two around the same time as well. So I have to think that they're trying to fulfill some sort of a chronological blueprint in terms of mass sacrifice and deceiving us into this culling tactic. You got to think not only of herd mentality, but herd management and how these guys really control people like that and fight against male populations to really keep people from being unjusted in the way they systematically do, from ever physically being able to revolt and do something about it.
But Chris, who do you think started the opposition party in the United States?
In the United States? Wow. Yeah. I'd have to say, well, you know, would it be Jefferson's party would be on the Democrat side? And on the other side, it would be like, you know, the Hamilton, you know, those guys. I mean, I don't know, Madison as well.
I think you just nailed it, Chris. You just hit it right on the spot. But think about Washington's final inaugural address, which was, by the way, written by Alexander Hamilton. Washington probably didn't have enough going for him to write anything that would have been cohesive over that period of time. But Hamilton wrote this, but the classic battle, and you hit it right on the head, the classic battle that caused the great schism, if you will, in the American politics in the very beginning was Alexander Hamilton v. Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson even left the cabinet as Secretary of State because of Alexander Hamilton. It's been my position for many years of study that George Washington was the first classic figurehead. He was not running the government, the government was being run by Alexander Hamilton, who even went to Congress as the Secretary of Treasury and wrote laws. And when Jefferson was questioning, hey, what in the hell is going on here to Washington? Washington was in Mount Vernon and not in Philadelphia, where the law, or New York, either one, where the law was actually being made. Washington wasn't even there. Jefferson writes to Washington and says, hey, what's going on here? Look, I've got 24 questions for you about this government. What is happening with the government? And then if you track it, 2 days later, Washington writes a letter to Hamilton and says, hey, what the hell's going on here? Answer these 24 questions as if they were his own questions. And now we're going to have, Chris, in August, a writer, a Jewish writer, is now going to document and prove that Alexander Hamilton was a Jew. And he was obviously working at the Constitutional Convention. He left five times, went back to New York for consultation, came back to the convention. And I believe without a doubt that he was going back to New York to consult with the Jewish masters. I think the evidence is there.
That's fascinating, Mike, on several levels, because here we have this concept of a puppet president being run from behind the scenes by a guy who is certainly a representative of the City of London and the banking cartel. And I guess it's an all intents purpose. Possibly Hamilton was actually a bastard child of one of these bankers. Is that correct?
Could be.
Yes, there is a very good proof, and I believe the Jews are, this author is ready to step out there now and to document the fact that he was a Jew. The problem was, is that they could not put a Jew in the government back then because the Jews were excluded from government, but they had to have an influence. So they create this guy Hamilton and say that he was the bastard child of his mother, who was married to a Jew, who's buried in a Jewish cemetery. And so they had to create a character. They had to put a character in to the influence. I mean, where did a broke young kid from Nevis find the money to come to the United States and go to college for 4 years? Somebody had
that's
to find
down in the that. That's Mike. That's down in the Caribbean, right?
Yes.
And so, did you say his mother was buried in a Jewish cemetery?
Yes, she is buried in a Jewish cemetery. I have documentation of that.
Oh well, if the other guys might be able to clarify this, but you don't get admission to that kind of turf unless you're Jewish, right?
Exactly.
Question. Yeah.
Wow, that's fascinating. Sounds a lot like Bill Clinton's life in a way. Where did a poor old boy from Arkansas become president of the United States? You know,
all these guys upward, man. It's amazing. They all fall upward. It's so astonishing. But like, yeah, Hamilton, in this case, you think that maybe his him being a proxy for this banking interest and maybe his collision with Burr could have led into like a conflict of, say, these investment opportunities they had going on in the New World? Because I know Burr was all over mining developments and trying to start up an English settlement in Mexico and in the far Southwest and things like that for the British Empire. I think these guys were both, agents of this aristocracy, not necessarily to save for the British Empire, because the people in the British Empire are getting so screwed at that time. They were so broke. The common man was just destitute as all hell and really treated poorly, let's just say, in the face of this, while there's like a certain 1% that's getting such breakaway wealth as they always have. So this is like the same blueprint, you know, and they lead into like the robber baron age, the railroad barons and stuff like this, and into what becomes the military industrial complex.
Yeah, but Burr has the great honor and distinction of having killed Hamilton in a duel.
Yeah.
The only problem with that is he waited 10 years too long.
Right. No doubt.
But
there's only a minute left. Mike, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that the study of Aaron Burr is something we should take up, guys. I've done some extensive diving into Aaron Burr, a real character. Chris, it looks like you have as well. Someone that has just never been developed, the true character of Aaron Burr. And it is a fascinating story. Especially the conflict between Burr and Jefferson is huge. And Burr's connection with Luther Martin, you know, who is one of my favorite founders. And no, not Martin Luther, folks, Luther Martin. And he represented, Thomas Jefferson said Luther Martin was a federal bulldog that should be put down.
Okay, welcome back to the third and final hour of Operation Scorpio. This second hour really flew by quickly with Daryl Wayne, Mr. Mike Gatti, and Dale from Salt Lake City. And really what I want to do on this hour is sort of kick off the hour by bringing up the Revolution of 1848. And it's not a terribly well-known topic, but it had deep implications on the United States and modern history, essentially. And I believe last Sunday, Dale, you brought up the Revolution of 1848 on Mike's show. So maybe you could start off and giving your assessment of the Revolution of 1848 and what it meant, and then we'll just kind of work our way around the roundtable.
Was that directed towards Dale out here in Salt Lake?
That's right. Yes, sir.
Right. So because Daryl and Dale are close enough that I can kind of confuse them. But anyway, I don't recall. I'm going to have a couple more clues. You know, I don't recall initiating that conversation.
Okay. Then let's start with Mr. Mike Gatti, the historian himself, and then we'll go to Daryl Wayne.
Well, in the 1848, throughout many parts of Europe, it was called the Revolution of 1848, and it was known to many as the Springtime of the People or the Springtime of Nations. And there was a quite a bit of political upheaval in the area at the time, all over Europe, and probably the most revolutionary wave in European history. But what happened is the socialists. And the, we might as well call it as it is, the Jewish socialists were trying to transform the government and in many cases were just invited out of the country, threatened with prison, threatened with execution and what have you. So they made a mass migration out of Europe, many of them finding their way to the United States. And during that time frame, when they came in, they usually involved themselves in the media of the day, the newspapers. And it was, in fact, this very faction which created the Republican Party in 1852. Now, we can go on from there if you want to, but I would like to have Daryl jump in there and kind of give me a critique if I hit the nail on the head or did I miss it?
Mike, they rose from the... right?
Thank you.
Daryl, go ahead.
Oh, I think you're over the target, Mike. Let's see. Well, what even causes the wars of 1848? Well, it's the outcome of the Napoleonic Wars, and that's what leads up to all these. Other monarchical conflicts. The Black Venetians understood well before the 1800s. They had a working idea in the 1700s that they had to destroy the monarchies, and they had to pit them against each other. And so, if you look at the Prussian Wars, where the German states were pitted against the other European powers, all these Prussian states, you can see that there's a deep influence from actors that are coming out of the French Revolution. So these conflicts throughout these history and these timelines and these centuries are not just individual compartmentalized events. They are progressives on an agenda. And this is what was going on in 1848. Now, this was also a period when the major conversations that were going on in the cafes of that time were, associated with socialism. the big intellectual question that during this time period is socialism and who's involved in this. Well, there's a little group in Germany called the Young Hegelians, and none other than a very young and aspiring Karl Marx is deeply involved in this with others. This is the undertow. I'm just trying to set up the stage here a little bit, that there's this a cultural and economic, social, economic, political schism that's being foisted into the political and intellectual conversations, and the working man is just trying to make a living, you know, and he gets dragged into this political conversation. So I know Chris has got something to say here, because I know you've looked into this, Chris. Jump in here, would you?
Yeah, I'd also like to add to your points. Great stuff there, always, man. You guys are just amazing to talk to. I have to say that also you can look into the Carbonieri and the rise of say, the common men in the Italian era around the same time. It's like a color revolution that was going on in 1848. Glad Judeo-Masonic originated a lot of this stuff from London and from Basel, Switzerland. You know, Garibaldi, Mazzini running a lot of these things early on, and they even lead into what become the Civil War and many of the stuff in the 1860s as well in the same areas. So, yeah, I think they're really, like you say, transitioning from the I think back into the Napoleonic realm. I think they go back to Napoleon III in 1848, if I'm correct, from like Charles X and then his descendant going Bourbon and then back to Napoleon in the second quote-unquote revolution of 1848 and supposedly establishing, I think, the Second French Republic, but I could be wrong. And then eventually comes the Second French Empire when he, you know, rules as an autocrat 3 years later or something like that. So, yeah, this is really the old money doing this again. Think about like DuPont in any of these wars, you know, from like, say World War One on, you know, selling most of the gunpowder to both sides, or, you know, these munition factories selling to both sides while we depopulate ourselves. You know, they have an entire destruction and rebuilding economy, a tohu and takun, as you'd call it, creation and destruction that they tried to bring in through these type of forces, the rise and fall of empires as well. So this is a formula that has been put on through time, and really they use time against us and our own limited information and our limitless emotions as well, because we know something's wrong, but we can't really quite historically put a finger on it, because like Mike brilliantly brought up, they run these publishing companies, like Daryl brought up, they run these salons that basically were steering the literature and the culture of the era. They're the ones that commission these artists, these paintings, everything that becomes accepted in culture, and really more importantly, whatever becomes the official narrative is what we know as history. Everything else is lost, you know, and that's why, because these guys understand damn well that they can control the past, they can control the present and the future.
Mm-hmm. Good point, Chris. Giuseppe, why don't you jump in? What are your thoughts on the Revolution 1848 and, you know, the implications and the importance of it to America in the world history?
Well, I really need to defer to Daryl, Chris, and Mike. I mean, I just have a very overview perspective of it all, and it was just the occasional every 50 to 100 years, the internationalist Jew wants to stir things up and wants to, engage in some type of subversive wealth transfer while they create a divide and conquer. In this instance, seems to me that they were trying to make sure that they could deliver a very crippling blow to monarchies and to therefore empower the banking systems of the day, the central bankers.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, okay. Well, Mike, let's hand it over to you, because you are the resident historian. Why did these people end up, how did this end up making a huge sort of immigration of Jewish people as the result of those events?
Well, we have basically what I would like to call the socialist movement, the socialists that moved into America. You know, there are so many ramifications for this, because, you know, they have, like from 1853, 1854 to 1856 to create the Republican Party in America. And so then their first candidate, I'm trying to think of his name. He was a Civil War general later on, California, Oh, well, anyway. Fremont, John C. Fremont. There we go. First day with my new brain. John C. Fremont becomes the candidate, and he is an avowed socialist, even in 1848. So we know that the first candidate for the Republican Party was the socialist. They learned a very good trick at that time. They found out that, hey, we can't run a person who professes our political stance and get elected. So they worked subversively to get many of the people that they were able to buy, as they're always able to do. If you look at any movement, as was described by Chris and Giuseppe, you have people who come in and they use their funds to buy the people that they need to create the atmosphere that they want. And of course, you know, they bought Greeley, Horace Greeley, and they put in Charles A. Dana as his assistant editor or his editor in chief. And Charles A. Dana was a close friend of Karl Marx. And most of the articles that are published during that time era in the Tribune, which was Greeley's newspaper, the majority of the commentary was written by Karl Marx. Karl Marx wrote over 5,000 commentaries for the paper, and even JFK referenced that at one time, that the amount of, you know, philosophy, political philosophy that was put into the minds of the people through Karl Marx. Well, you get into 1862, 1863 under Lincoln, after they get Lincoln elected president, you get the program going. And so Charles A. Dana shifts from the editor of the New York Tribune. He shifts to being the assistant secretary of war for Abraham Lincoln. And Lincoln had several generals in the Union Army who weren't even U.S. citizens. Many of them had come. Sickle was one. You had I'm trying to think of the other one, starts with a W. He had several generals of, you know, who were actually commanding large armies for him that weren't even U.S. citizens. And if you get to the rape of Athens, Alabama, oh, man, that gets to be a good one, where a Russian by the name of Turgayevich had changed his name to Turpin, and he just burned the town of and there were no Confederate forces there. Rosecrans, General Rosecrans, calls for his court-martial because of that. And so he is court-martialed for his offense of burning a town, a defenseless town. And then Charles A. Dana, Assistant Secretary of War, works through his connections. And then Abraham Lincoln not only puts Turpin back in the Union Army, but promotes him from colonel to general after he burned a town in northern Alabama. So the implications of how they infiltrated and how they became basically the what we refer to as the radical Republicans were, in fact, these Marxist-influenced socialists. And in a letter from Marx, he congratulated Lincoln on his 1864 election. And as I can find it, he is the first person to mention to Lincoln that the South should be reconstructed.
That's interesting, Mike. So you're really laying out the case that there's a direct correlation between the Revolution 1848 and the American Civil War.
Absolutely. I don't think there's any doubt. They use their money. I mean, let's stop and look at the Dred Scott case. You've got a case that goes before the Missouri Supreme Court, and Dred Scott had been taken into Wisconsin, he and his family, which under the present law meant that he was free. And so he goes the case in Missouri. The Missouri Supreme Court agrees with him, says you are free, but then 11 years of wrangling, political wrangling, to get that case before the Supreme Court in 1857. Well, where in the hell did Dred Scott get the money to have a continuing court battle for 11 years?
Right. And those are the kind of questions we're not supposed to ask or think about, you know. Dale, I want to make sure, Dale from Salt Lake, I want to make sure you have a chance to jump in here. Do you have anything to add right now?
Well, I am in assimilation mode here. I'm a student in this conversation, and that's not false modesty, believe me. I had no idea that there was a dialogue of this stature going on, even on the very broad plane of the internet. So I am making a lot of notes here, and I'm going to have to re-listen to the conversation. I do have a question going back, step back just a little bit. I think it was Daryl talking about the Black Venetians. Daryl, would they be Sephardim, or would they be Sephardic nobility, so to speak, the Black Venetians?
Right. Well, that's what I'm referring to, is sort of a euphemism for the Rothschild Money Trust.
Go ahead.
Yeah. That's really all it is. I mean, there's a legacy power structure here, and the money trust comes out of Venice, goes to Spain, goes to the Netherlands, then implants itself into Europe. In England, William the Orange, and just moves forward. You can trace this pig in the python, if you will, from Venice all the way to the Bank of England and now to the Federal Reserve System. So that's who I was referring to as the Black Venetians. So
the reason I ask is because, and I guess it's a little bit on the esoteric side for most people, but people usually, the banker, the responsibility for the pedigree of the central bankers, it's hung on the Ashkenazi side of the house, the so-called European Jews. There are people, pretty scholarly people, who go nuts when you repeat that mantra, though, and they say, no, the true top of the pyramid in the Jewish power structure is Sephardic. I guess it isn't going to matter to some people, but it matters to me. I don't want to be inaccurate in the few things I know about this situation. So, I mean, you see what I'm saying? There's an argument
Dale, this is part of your factional dialectic. You have the low level basic users, you know, exploiters, right. And your regional Ashkenazi, low level money changer, and then you got the Venetians, and the Venetians are Sephardic, and they're very traceable, easily traceable, and they now presently reside in the city of London. So,
well, they found a way to survive they found a way to survive the Reconquista, and so they had to be pretty heavy people. I mean, is it not true that Ferdinand and Isabella allowed or found it convenient to let a lot of these people survive once the Moors were ostensibly expelled? So they were packing some serious influence, power, money, obviously, to be able to get that kind of a grace from the Spanish nobility, I would think.
Can I jump in?
I think you're accurate about that. Yeah, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I just have to say that from, like, say, the 1480s to about the 1680s, in this 200-year span, I found at least 15 different times that the Spanish Empire has been bankrupted, and about 10 or 11 of those times have been to the Jews of Augsburg, or even ones that are, like, you know, branches from, like, the Venetians, or even into Basel and London, like, eventually go to London after that, you know, after the Dutch War and all that. But, yeah, what Daryl's saying is pretty much right. I don't think these guys put all their eggs in one basket, though. I think they pretty much go into all these merchant cities cities and all these port cities, and they infiltrate these places. They understand the importance of trade. So this is why they put their people in under disguise or under the cloak of being local or under a different identity, but truly holding a different loyalty to this brotherhood or to this thing. You know, we call them Jews or whatever you want to call them, you know, Judeo-Masonic, whatever, Masons. Ultimately, this is a departmentalized order that has been put in place and has respected this secret order for a long, long time. And it's stuff that those of us that have no idea what the heck's going on or have just studied it in passing or even made it a hobby or even worse, maybe understand different levels of this, but I don't think we'll really ever understand truly how these guys have superseded and exceeded most of these empires and gone on to take the wealth from all these places. You're seeing them do it now in America and moving on to other places, but it's just true how they do this.
Well, and you know, Derek, well, earlier you mentioned, you know, the Black Venetians, and it's interesting too that, you know, modern central banking really sort of originated in Venice, went to Venice and then the Netherlands and then to the city of London. But it seems that the origins of modern central banking really lie in Venice.
Yeah, bond market too.
Yeah, for the people in the chat and the listening audience and anybody here, Dale, you might find this book very helpful. It's not really that thick and it's very dense. It moves well. The book is by Robert Ingraham and the title is The Modern Anglo-Dutch Empire: Its Origins, Evolution, and get this, Anti-Human Outlook.
Wow.
So if you want to, you want a good read, very accurate for all as I can tell, and it's very dense. He doesn't wander much. He gets right to the point. And he brings it from Venice all the way through. So, it's what does this have to do with the wars of 1848? The Prussian Wars. They call them the German. It's actually Prussia. Prussia is a bunch of little states, and they're always, guess what these Germans are, these Prussians are always doing? They're beating each other up, right, Mike? They're always fighting because there's a count or a duke or there's... Go figure, you know, and they're always beating each other up. So they're already divided in contest, and this sort of goes back to the same things that were going on in Italy with the city states, okay? And the people that like to loan money for wars were playing both sides of all these things all the time. There's a pattern here. There's a consistent money pattern. So what comes out of the Prussian Wars is the German state. And as E. Michael Jones will tell you, after the Prussian fiefdoms and kingdoms are now consolidated into the German state, the economist for this is Friedrich Liszt. And as E. Michael Jones says, he's not a piano player. He's the most important economist you've never heard of, Friedrich Liszt. And they create the socialist German state is what happens. And the people, a semi-socialist, but still has a king. And but the important thing about the 1848, as it applies to the American side of the geopolitics, is what happens to the defeated people, Mike? And what was the demographic of military leaders and generals and majors and colonels in the war of the Northern aggression?
Well, they were to a great deal German and many of socialist leaning. Of course, then you had the drunk Ulysses S. Grant, and you had the gentleman who was taken out of the nut farm, William Tecumseh Sherman. They had the greatest of character in their Union generals. If you contest that, if you want to, with the wonderful actual moral character of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson and a few others. So it was a very strong socialist background. Of course, let's not forget, though, that the Confederacy had their resident, what Stonewall Jackson referred to as, Jefferson Davis's pet Jew. Let's not forget the influence of Judah P. Benjamin on the effect. And Stonewall Jackson threatened to resign from his position as a general in the Confederacy if they allowed Judah P. Benjamin to remain as the as Secretary of War. Big conflict there, because I believe without a doubt that Jackson knew exactly what Judah P. Benjamin was doing. And the story of when Richmond fell, of Judah P. Benjamin and Jefferson Davis leaving, heading to Texas with the Confederates' gold, and somewhere near Abbeville, South Carolina, they are caught by the Union cavalry, but Judah P. Benjamin wasn't there, and neither was the Confederate gold. And so where does Judah P. Benjamin end up? In France. So how did he get from Abbeville, South Carolina, to France? There's a lot of mysteries here that are, for a historian, are just absolutely fun to try to run down these rabbit holes.
Well, and, Michael, this goes to another, you know, bigger picture here, which is, you know, like Hamilton, you're describing another infiltrator that inserted himself into a movement and was able to derail it into a completely different direction. How do you think that these infiltrators are able to do this so easily throughout time? It just amazes me.
Well, go back and look at the fact that I'm trying to think his James, trying to think of his first name. There was a Rothschild, a 24-year-old Rothschild that was touring the United States during the 1858 to 1860 period and sending reports back to his uncle in France about the political structure. He was traveling. He was much celebrated in both North and South. They had banquets for him and dinners for him. And he wrote a series of letters back there. I have all 13 of those letters, copies of those letters that he wrote back. And there's no doubt. I mean, when you look at it, just like Chris mentioned about DuPont selling powder to both sides during World War One, we have at this in the law of Nolven aggression, we have the fact that the Jewish bankers were selling involved in financing both wars. And of course, if you go back to when Lincoln issued the greenback to finance the war, he did that after contacting the international bankers, and the international bankers said, sure, we'll be glad to loan you money to finance your war. We'll be more than happy to loan it to you at 30% interest.
And Mike, the researchers will no longer find the documents supporting what you just said about that recon sent out by the central banks. Is that correct?
Oh, that was an accident. They didn't mean to lose those letters, Dale.
Yeah, I don't know if that's something we want to touch on or not. I leave it to you.
Oh, I have the letters. Be happy to give them to anyone who would like to have copies of those letters. They're quite interesting. Ironically, after the war, this member of the Rothschild family meets an untimely death at 29. Now, if you want to try to find out what happened to him, good luck. But they have been
expunged. If you were a Mike Gatti trying to find those documents now, you better find Mike Gatti because they're.
Well, one of the things I learned, gentlemen, many years ago, and I was fortunate in that somehow I was I thought, you know, because I had read 1984. So I got to be thankful because of that. When I was at the National Archives, when I was at the Library of Congress, University of Virginia, other places, when I would see these documents that I felt like were crucial, I would get copies of them. And, you know, a lot of my copies have the stamp of the Library of Congress or the National Archives in the corner of the document, you know, with their little logo that says not for resale, which, you know, they wouldn't sell you a copy that you could go out and make a lot of copies of and resale. So they put that onto the document. But those documents, and now I have noticed how many of those documents are disappearing, including a very short story. I had a gentleman who was a retired colonel from Pagosa Springs, Colorado, who used to drive to Cortez, Colorado, to attend my classes. And I had given out the contents of one of my documents. And a couple of years ago, he wrote to me and said, hey, can you send me a copy of that document? I've got some people who are questioning. I said, sure. So I sent it to him. And then later I get an email or a phone call. I can't remember which one. But anyway, he contacts me and he says, guess what? I called the Library of Congress and asked them to have a copy. Could I have a copy of that document? They told me it's no longer available to the American public. So the purge of, as you reference, and I went into a long-winded diatribe there, I apologize, but these records are disappearing like crazy, either disappearing or like the essays of Sentinel, which is 212 pages, 24 essays of Sentinel, you can get at Amazon now for a mere $800. So they're either pricing them out of range or they're making them where you can't get them at all.
Oh, Mike, this is fascinating. You know, it's interesting too, how there's certain lines you just don't cross. It doesn't matter, you know, who you are in terms of, you know, so-called power in the public realm. You cross a certain line and you're dead. And it looks like that was sort of the death knell for Lincoln for daring to print his own money to fund the war. And Kennedy tried a similar tactic and ended up with the same fate.
I couldn't agree more on. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Darryl.
No. Just real quickly for as a reference for everybody on this important information. There was a book written in 1961 called A Casual View of America. It was written by Sigmund Diamond, and it's the home letters of Salmon de Rothschild, 1859 to 1861. It has all of his letters in there that he was allowed to print. and you can get a little piece of history. Well, you can still get it if you can get it. The one copy I had cost me $160. It was only printed one time. It's never been in reprint. So maybe you can find a PDF somewhere.
Yeah, that's right. Solomon James Rothschild. That was the name. Thanks, Darryl. Appreciate that.
Darryl, do you care to repeat the title just for the listeners?
The title is A Casual View of America. Yeah, he was just over here. He was taking a walk in the park. I was just out and about, thought I'd stop by. A Casual View of America. Yeah.
And what happened to him? He was killed.
He was
dying.
Well,
his life ended at 29.
Shortly after returning. Yeah.
Well, Mike, what do you think happened to this man?
Returning to France.
He was murdered?
I've done quite a bit of research trying to determine what happened to him. And, you know, at first my thought was, well, so what? But, you know, for a man to give such a valuable service. And I will tell you that there are internet sites that will show you some letters from Rothschild. I will tell you to his uncle. I will tell you now, those letters are different from the ones I have. So I'm not sure if they have supplanted those letters with less revealing letters about his true purpose or not. I'm not sure, but there's that PPN article is a good one that you're scrolling through there, Giuseppe. But the articles that I have, when I found those 25, 30 years ago, and I now compare them with what they're publishing, like in these articles, the letters are significantly different.
Mike, could you sort of encapsulate what do you think some of the most important things that were contained in those letters that might have been or being expunged now?
Well, he was giving them what would be at that time would be unobtainable intel about the what was going on in the political circles, both North and South. And without his letters, without him being entertained and being doing the elbow rubbing with all of these officials, and his letters were most exhaustive about exactly what the mindset of the people were.
Oh, wow. Okay. Murr and Tony Baloney, Tony found a link there for A Casual View of America on archive.org, and I'll post that in the main chat there. Good find. It's like I'm doing my show here, and I'm just sitting around taking notes, just having my mind blown over and over again by the dots being connected by this conversation. Chris, why don't you jump in, man? Where do you want to
I think this is some good stuff. If you look into like August Belmont, one of the Rothschild operatives that took control of the Democratic Party, famous for things like Tammany Hall and the extent of this corruption that leads into this whole control opposition dialogue. Even as Mike was talking about the formation of the Republican Party serving industrial interests for these robber barons, for these mining operations that are mostly, you know, centered in London or even creating a Chicago Mercantile Exchange through Vanderbilt and many of these guys and using the railroads to really strip the mining assets of the United States. They use both lawmen and outlaw alike. These Masonic orders put in these type of guys. If you think about all the Civil War generals on both sides, they're all Masons. Same thing with like most of these outlaws and most of these lawmen as well. And if you look at these mining operations, most of these Civil War generals were either railroad executives or land speculators or real estate lawyers or things like this, bankers. So, I think this is really an aristocracy that's really set out to use the people under a different rhetoric while providing or serving a different agenda secretly. And ultimately, I think that this is how they really call the fighting age male population. Like I was saying earlier, it's really necessary in terms of putting these type of things in. And if you get into some of the like the Boston Brahmin operations that are coming out in the 1830s and 40s and as far as steering culture, whether it's the abolitionist movement, the Underground Railroad, the Transcendentalist movements, onto like this theocratic Great Awakening type concept through like the Russell Trust and all these guys, they're running both the overworld and the underworld. These guys are running opium and stuff out of China like crazy. So and bringing it here to the United States and really trying to get the natives as well as the middle class addicted to drugs, harness them in slums, exploit their labor and really run the world by controlling the trade. So ultimately, the banking institution they put in with the Federal Reserve gives them such an unfair advantage at that point that free market capitalism is just a punchline to these guys, really, and something that we march for and die for. But ultimately, these guys understand is absolutely a shit show. If you put these corrupt bankers in front of any political offering or any idea, and you allow them to control the dialogue and to render these offerings to you, they will absolutely screw you. So I almost am thinking that Shakespeare's right. The first thing we do is kill all the lawyers. I'm not saying advocating murder, but I'm saying we got to get them the hell out of here, because all these lawyers are agents of London, and you're not going to find a lawyer on earth that's going to fight in a court of law for the common man.
Interesting. Giuseppe, you've been oddly quiet. Let's get you in on the convo, baby.
Well, go ahead. Speaker Scorpio, I defer my 5 minutes to far greater historians than I, in the great Gaddy and the great Weinert and the great Wayne. So I'm just listening, man. Their knowledge dwarfs mine. I don't have anything really to add. I mean, I'm just a student here.
Hey, Chris. Yeah.
If
I could throw in a question for Chris here. Chris, who were the three people that negotiated the peace treaty with King George for America?
Well, I would have to say maybe Jay would have been one of them, but I don't know. I'm really not sure. I'd have to say Jefferson, Hamilton, probably Madison, maybe. I don't know. I'm throwing four out there, but maybe hopefully one of the three will hit.
Well, you're one for three, and that will get you in the Hall of Fame.
Okay.
They are the three people who negotiated were John Gates and negotiation free the empire after their negotiations. All of the delegates from France involved, I mean, from England, all had Esquire as well. And the crazy thing about the Treaty of 1783 is the fact that in that treaty, King George is listed as Prince of the United States.
Mike, you seriously garbled when you were explaining.
Yeah, can you repeat like the first part? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Where did I mess up?
At the beginning, at the very beginning.
At the beginning. Well, that's what my wife said. The three men who negotiated the Treaty of Paris, the three men from America were Benjamin Franklin, John Adams, and John Jay. And in those negotiations, all with England in the treaty, all three are listed with their names, Esquire. And the delegates from England are also listed as Esquire. So then in the final peace treaty, it is written that King George III is the Prince of the United States. Now, who signs a peace treaty with someone they have just defeated and makes their leader the prince of the country who won the war?
Well, Mike, how do you interpret that? That's interesting. What's that to you?
You look at that after the war, Dave. I hope I don't get too circuitous here with the answer. But if you look at after the war, you look at how hard Alexander Hamilton as an attorney, almost all of his cases as an attorney was securing the property of the Tories, the people who had supported England and had lost their property during the war. He went about securing their property. Where on the other hand, Luther Martin in Maryland was spending most of his legal expertise taking their land of the Tories. So we have the two people there. I think that is most telling, but I'm not sure in many ways. I believe that in the minds of the international bankers, America was still just another branch of England and their banking enterprises. And I believe they accomplished and made sure that happened through Alexander Hamilton primarily. But Adams was also very much involved in that as well.
Well, and look what happened, to confirm your, suspicion there. Look what happened when a charter of the first central bank in the United States ran out in 1811, where suddenly attacks the United States and even burns down the White House.
Yeah, we 1812.
Charter in 1816.
Right. And rechartered in 1816. But that wasn't the first bank, gentlemen. Let's not forget the Bank of North America in 1781. That was the first huge bank. And our big guy, Robert Morris, involved in that, who was obviously, in my opinion, obviously a tool of the international bankers starting in 1781. Because the $400,000+ in gold that had been loaned to the United States to fight Britain, Robert Morris, as the chief financier, immediately takes $270,000 of that money, loans it out to his friends and cronies, and then they buy interest in the Bank of North America. So he embezzled $270,000+ right off the bat. So, and obviously, who condoned that? Why was that allowed to happen?
That's interesting. And, if I didn't know better, I'd think that history really was sort of constructed by a cabal of bankers that control things by the lending of money. And, it's interesting, even the Game of Thrones, the central player in all of it is the Iron Bank, who everyone has to bend a knee to. And, that's an interesting little side bit, too. Daryl, what... Do you want to jump in, man? Go ahead.
Well, since we're back into the Revolutionary War period, I want to tie up a few loose ends that'll be informative about Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. there's a lot going on here. I don't really believe that Aaron Burr is a good guy. I haven't found too many good guys, in much to my regret in researching all this for years, and learning from Michael. I believe Patrick Henry was, and you can, the list is pretty short after that, but, Aaron Burr, is playing games in the business world and in the banking world, and is charged with conspiracies of trying to actually split the Republic at that time, in that time period. Is, I think Michael probably has more deep information on this area if he would share it with us sometime. But after the duel where Alexander Hamilton is killed, Aaron Burr takes off. he leaves the country. And where does he go after he leaves? He goes to England. He goes to England, and where does he live? He goes to the house of a one Jeremy Bentham, B-E-N-T-H-A-M-S, Bentham, not S. And he lives there for 5 years and basically becomes a part of Jerry Benton's household. And he doesn't return to the United States until on the eve of the War of 1812. Now, who is Jeremy Bentham? Jeremy Bentham is an important figure. So let me give you a little insight into Jeremy Bentham. It won't take very long. Jeremy Bentham is part of the directory of the British intelligence of that time period. He's MI5 and MI6 before MI5 and MI6 exist. How about that? Wow. Very interesting. He has his friends. He was a serious. Not only was he in British intelligence, and he is the originator. He is credited with the word panopticon, which was a design for a prison of special note. That can be researched by people who want to look farther into that. But he was also a political philosopher, and his buddies in the U.S. Were not only Aaron Burr, but Madison Franklin, Benjamin Franklin, John Jay, and John Quincy Adams all had close relationships with this guy. And he's a player. So isn't it interesting that Aaron Burr has a duel, Alexander Hamilton dies, he's up on conspiracy charges for treason, and the first place he runs to is the one of the directors of British intelligence at the time period, Jerry Benton's house, and lives with him for 5 years. Fascinating, isn't it? Isn't that interesting?
Well, I got a question for you, Daryl, and everything you stated is true, but here's a question. In 1805, Thomas Jefferson tells the Congress of the United States, he's president, he tells the Congress of the United States he has concrete, irrefutable evidence of Aaron Burr's treason. And he taunts that. I mean, he makes that public. He says it publicly. He has incontrovertible evidence. Well, then they have the trial of Aaron Burr. And one of his lawyers, of course, again, is Luther Martin. So Luther Martin says, okay, the president has stated such in the trial. And of course, the judge is none other than John Marshall, who frequently has dinner with Aaron Burr during the trial. Now, that's a good one. But anyway, so the Luther Martin subpoenas the president for his irrefutable evidence, and he also subpoenas the president of the United States to testify at the trial. So Well, one of the earliest times in American history, Thomas Jefferson declares executive privilege and states he will not testify and he will not send his evidence. So if this evidence was so good and Jefferson had it, why would he not present it?
Could he somehow? Well, maybe he got a bloody horse head in his bed one night and he just changed his mind.
Well, that might have occurred, but, you know, the thing I think about, you know, I give Aaron Burr credit in some places, and of course, I don't think he was a saint by any stretch of the imagination, but after Luther Martin had a stroke and was unable to continue, Aaron Burr brought him to New York, and that's where Luther Martin lived until he passed away. Of course, then they buried him, and he was buried in an unmarked grave, and now it's paved over. So Luther Martin is not one of America's greatest heroes, but I put him right in there with Patrick Henry as one of the good guys of the American Revolution.
And Luther Martin had financial difficulty at that time too, right?
Pardon me?
And Luther Martin had come into financial difficulty, which is why he had to be sort of taken in by him, correct?
Oh, big time. And one of the only people in history that I can find that when he did, after he had the stroke, he would find his way. He couldn't talk very well. He couldn't, you know, communicate because of the stroke, but he would still find his way to the courthouse and sit in and listen to trials. But the Bar Association of Maryland, you know, if a Bar Association ever did anything decent, the Bar Association of Maryland had each member of the bar to contribute a annual amount to keep Luther Martin going. But yes, he did. He hit some terrible financial straits. Well, you know, a lot of people don't know that Thomas Jefferson was heavily in debt when he passed away.
Right. Yeah. Well, guys, you know, we're down to the last couple of minutes, and I just want to thank everyone for coming on. These 2 hours have just flown by. I feel like I've been in class during my show here. I'm going to have to go back and listen to my own show. Because there's just so much information that was put forth today. Dale, you know, from Salt Lake, I really want to thank you for coming on, and I hope we can get you to come back again soon. Could you give us some final thoughts, please?
Oh, I have so many thoughts. This has been more than stimulating to just be a fly on the wall in this conversation. It's a real opportunity. One of the flights of fancy that my mind undertook listening to Mike just now was it has to do with Jefferson very quickly. That you know, Jefferson's model, as I understand it, for the way society would be organized on this continent was to spread the population out and have landowners. And, you know, gentlemen farmers from coast to coast. And I understand that because of the nature of the delivery of goods and services and water and sewage and everything, there's a natural tendency, particularly after the Industrial Revolution, for population to concentrate somewhat. But I also see the fingerprint of those who on this continent, that those who wanted to concentrate, wanted to amplify that natural process. And of course, we've seen that now in the rural depopulation program of the New World Order, the final stages of getting people off of the land, making it unaffordable, untenable to be out on the land. And Mike, someday I'd like you to talk about if you believe that Jefferson's model was deliberately suppressed, and we were very early on, and we were handed a program. That made it look like you had to, it was not practical to distribute the land to the ordinary man. I'd like you to comment on that sometime in a future show. Maybe I'll be a listener. Maybe I'll be here listening directly, but I'd sure like to know your opinion and the others on the line presently as well.
Okay, Mike, go ahead. We've only got 1 minute, so try to encapsulate a huge question into 1 minute.
Well, I'm not going to attempt to answer that because I couldn't even scratch the surface at this point in time. I would look forward to doing that in the future. But what I want to thank you, gentlemen, all of you, for allowing me to be a part of this, because I come away reinvigorated every time we do these shows. Giuseppe, you are a class act, and I, it's been a pleasure to get to know you. Chris, I am amazed at your intellectual level and everything that you do as well. And Dave, you're my producer. You're my friend. I don't know what else to say. And DW, sometimes I like you.
Well, I'd like to interject one quickly that I have been so impressed with all of you that I have made arrangements for each of you to make a deposit at the Genius Sperm Bank.
Uh-oh. I think the bank may default, but that's,
eugenics.
Oh, I found it.